Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to another special edition of the Supertone Show.
David Bowie. And Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, the title track from his 14th studio album, released on the 12th of September in 1980 by RCA Records. And it was Bowie's final studio album on the RCA label, and also his first following the Berlin trilogy of Low, Heroes and Lodger from 1977 to 79. And the album went platinum and peaked at number one in the UK and successfully restored Bowie's commercial standing in the US.
But really, even though we're talking about Bowie here, and that's the whole of this show, and the next one, we're not talking about him, we're talking about the guitar players that have played with him. Because we decided we're really getting into this guitar playing thing again, and we've been listening to loads of stuff. I think it's coming up to the next album, isn't it? You know, we're just listening and getting as much inspiration from him as possible. And you cannot get more inspiration than the guitar player on that record who played most of the lead, Robert Fripp.
Now, you know about Robert Fripp.
Well, he's a monster guitar player. And the thing about Robert Fripp is that you always know it's him, because it sounds like he's torturing the guitar. He comes up with, like, such alternative lines and solos that they're almost unimaginable. And it is jazz, but it's sort of rocky jazz, but it's not Mahavishnu Vishnu Orchestra. It's not sort of John McLaughlin jazz. It's like just odd. But, you know, David Bowie is a master of getting great guitar players to play his records, and that's what we're going to feature over the next two shows.
Yeah.
And and Fripp actually started, of course, you know, you're going to talk a little about him, but his real claim to fame is Frippatronics.
Yeah.
And Frippatronics is basically, when he started, he had two Revox A77 recording machines next to one another.
Tape machines.
Yeah, that's right, tape machines. And what he used to do, he used to put the spool on one side, run it across the heads of one of the machines.
Okay.
And then it goes to the other machine without collecting on the other spool. So what he did, he had two machines, which was creating a delay. And how he actually increased the delay was by moving the machines further apart.
Literally
moving them further apart, yeah. So, of course, this is all, you know, everybody does this sort of thing now, but, you know, you look at the Beatles and what Jeff Emmerich did with George Martin and stuff with ADT, which is like automatic double tracking, which is a very quick delay on the voice. You'll hear it a lot on John Lennon's vocals. It's like a da-da. So it sounds like he's singing twice.
Yeah.
That's right. And it's sort of ADT. But this is Frippatronics. And he's always been a master of fuzz. He's just incredible. And I think each of the Bowie albums that we're going to, and tracks that we're going to feature over the next couple of shows, are highlighting one specific guitar player. And I just love Robert Fripp. But you know a lot about him because you've done an awful lot of research today on him. So
I'm buzzing.
Tell me about Roberto.
I've crammed the whole show in about 7 hours and I've been reading and hanging out with him, you know. I mean, what's inspirational for me and what I'm kind of intrigued by, it's like I can do all this research and it's good just to know the context, but I like you telling me and talking to me about it because I don't know what Robert Fripp sounds you like. I don't know that it's him, yet when I hear a song, you'll know it's him and I don't. And that's the bit I want to get to.
Well, I think after this,
where I understand more.
Yeah, this show, you really will, because he's so distinctive.
Yeah.
You know, he's as distinctive as any other guitar player.
But it's also about the music. And I think what I've, and I'm paraphrasing now because I don't want to get stuck in legalistic sort of terminology here, as it were. But from what I can gather, I mean, he at 11 years old, he was playing rock. At 13, he went to jazz. And a couple of years later, he was doing modern jazz. And I think that was a difference, and why he sounds different is that he's got more of an influence and a background in avant-garde jazz and European classical music as opposed to blues, which was a lot of the players at the time.
That's right, yeah.
So that's what he brings to the table with this, and also this kind of technique of cross-picking and having these new standard tuning techniques, which I don't understand, but apparently that's what happens with him. And of course, Robert is in the progressive rock band King Crimson as well.
Yeah,
so, well, I mean, he works, yeah. he's, he's, um, he's an artist in his own right, completely. And I love these collaborations and stuff. So that's, I mean, the thing is, well, I don't know that song, you know, Scary Monsters, not really.
Well, that album, I remember getting it and it blew my socks off again because I love Diamond Dogs. I mean, we love Bowie, don't we? And I'm a huge, huge, huge Bowie fan over the years. But it's his guitar players that actually kept bringing me back to him, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, Fripp was one of the masters.
Well, what he used to say with when he was working with Bowie as well, he would say, right, just give me the chords, and he never had to sit down and write charts out. He didn't want that. He just got the chords off Bowie, and he said it was like giving him a map, a musical terrain kind of map, and then he'd just go in and record fresh, so he wasn't constrained by anything. And what Bowie was quite good at, from what I've understood as well, and what I'm learning, is that he has unusual chord. He puts unusual chords in songs and stuff.
He does, yeah.
So you can tell that's a kind of a Bowie thing as well. So I think what Bowie did is he brought people on board that would expand and explore the foundations of the songs that he imagined, and they would jam together over the years. You could see it all happening. But, I mean, how fantastic is that when you've got somebody of his calibre coming into the studio and
correct.
Working with you?
And I mean, this was produced by him and Tony Visconti, of course.
Yeah,
his long, you know, long-time collaborator and stuff.
Yeah.
But to me, it's my favourite rhythm section. Now, I know I get awful lot of bother. Well, apart from the, we're going to listen to another rhythm section in a minute. But this particular period with Dennis Davids and George Murray and Carl Salamar on guitars, on rhythm guitars, they formed a fantastic cohesive unit.
We'll be right back.
David Bowie, Fame, from his ninth studio album, Young Americans, released on the 7th of March 1975 on RCA Records, and was also released as a single on the 25th of July 1975 on RCA. And it was Bowie's biggest hit to that point in the US. His first number one, the Billboard 100 chart, as well as his first to break the top 10. So he really, and Carlos Alomar, of course, co-wrote this. Ka-ching.
With John Lennon.
With John Lennon, who was in the studio at the same
time. I didn't know that, you know. I was like, that's so cool.
Well, Earl Slick was playing on this as well, and you can hear that double interplay. It's really nice, you know, that very funky picking thing. But I think we want to focus on Carlos Alomar, because I think he's one of those people that was throughout his Bowie's career that he appeared more times on albums than even Mike Garson, the keyboard player.
That's right. He's the guy that's played on more Bowie albums than anybody else.
And again...
And you go, Carlos who? I'd never heard of him until you mentioned him. Isn't it funny?
Dennis Davis on drums. But anyway, talk to me about Carlos, because I don't actually know an awful lot about him, and that's why I wanted to find out and really focus on him. Go on.
Okay, so Carlos, I'll find out. He was born in 1951. Mm-hmm. He's a Puerto Rican guitarist, composer and arranger. He was the son of a Pentecostal minister, would you believe?
Blimey.
Raised up in New York City. And he taught himself guitar at age 10 and started playing professionally, right, from age 16. And he's backed the likes of James Brown, Chuck Berry and Luther Vandross, who's a mate of his.
And he was on this album, wasn't he, Luther?
This is kind of weird, yeah. So he met, I love these stories so much, right? So, and I did not know this about this lady either. Mm-hmm. In the mid-70s, he met David Bowie during sessions for Lulu's recording of a song that he'd written for her. Bowie had written a song called Can You Hear Me? And he was there producing Lulu's album.
Right.
Now, Lulu.
Well, we were talking about this earlier on because she did a cover of Man Who Sold the World, did she not?
Yes.
Yeah, so it was probably all connected.
But, you know, you don't realise just how in this scene she was, really. Because when I grew up, she kind of, you didn't realise she was that, she had that those kind of cool contacts. For me, she wasn't as cool as Bowie. It's odd.
Yeah.
And he's producing her album. It's just a bit odd.
But it's like Eno. Eno's always hanging around. Whenever there's coolness going on, you know, whenever it's Sub-Zero, Brian Eno's kicking around somewhere, you know, of Visconti.
Yeah,
you know, and it's right. And Alomar. Anyway, carry on about Alomar.
So Carlos Alomar. So what I love, and this is my bit of trivia, which I was going to, but it fits in the story really well, was between like 1968 and 1969, he toured, right, with James Brown for 8 months. And he quit the band after James Brown docked his wages for missing a music cue. We know about James Brown doing that, didn't he? Because he used to penalise the band.
And
so,
apparently Mark Knopfler is a bit of a stickler for getting things right as well. Anyway,
yeah, I was going to say that reminds me of someone else, and you've just reminded me who it is. Now, when these guys met, right, Carlos didn't know who David Bowie was. He said he was the like almost translucent. He was the whitest guy he'd ever seen in his life with bright orange hair. And you've got Bowie didn't know anything about Carlos, who'd already, you know, he's an established man. He was totally established and had his own career in America.
Wow.
So these guys started talking and he was going, tell me about what's a spider from Mars thing? You know, and then David Bowie's going, what's it like to tour James Brown, man? You know, and so he had like a sensibility from a British point of view in terms of what he thought R&B was. And Carlos was the American R&B. And he said, well, why don't you come out to some joints and let's check out some music? So they just hung out together. And then it was naturally something that happened. He said, David Bowie said to him, what kind of guitar do you play then? And he said, the kind that pays. Exactly. So that set the store for their professional
relationship.
Fantastic. So isn't that good? So I like that. So we've got this guy who, and I've read that Carlos has released a book, and what he said he loved about Bowie and him, why they got on so well, they were both curious. He was a curious guy, and he was quite inspirational to be with. And so, I mean, there's so much to say. I don't even know how to say it. It's just that I know that they got on really well as people, and they even shared an apartment for a time.
You know, together they created some fantastic music, didn't they?
Well, yeah, and also what happened is, I didn't realise as well, is that Visconti, after they recorded the majority of the Young Americans album, Visconti had gone back to the UK And then they went into Sigma Studios just for a day. I think it was, no, actually, no, it was
Record Pump, was it?
No, what it was, they went to Electric Lady Studios. Ah, that's right, yeah. With John Lennon, just for a day, and they were jamming, and they just recorded it. And the song came from a riff that Carlos had got from a blues song called Foot Stomping, it was a really good kind of riff, but it didn't sort of take the song anywhere, and he didn't want to just repeat a blues song. Unless you can improve it, then don't do a cover, yeah, sort of thing. So that's and then apparently John Lennon was just messing around, just improvising, singing AIM as opposed to Fame with an F.
Wow.
So that's how it all kind of came together. So and so actually Visconti didn't work on the recording of that at all. He didn't know it happened. It was actually co-produced by a guy called Harry Maslin.
Yeah,
he was the engineer.
Yeah.
So I mean, what I like about this is, I think what I've understood as well with the guitarists and with Bowie, that he's not constrained by, he's so into the music and the experimentation and keeping an open mind. And if you could do that with him, then you stayed in the band.
Up on the stair, we spoke of was and when, although I wasn't there. He said I was his friend, which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone a long, long time ago. Searched for form and land. For years and years I roamed. I gazed a gazeless stare at all the millions here. We must have died alone a long, long time ago.
David Bowie, and the Man Who Sold the World. That's the title track from his third studio album, which was released on the 4th of November in 1970 in the US on the Mercury record label, and not until April in 1971 in the UK.
Well, recorded at Trident Studios in London.
Of course. Love, love, love.
Yeah, and Tony Visconti on bass here, because Tony Visconti was originally a bass player.
It's true, isn't it? It's weird.
But, of course, the guitar player is Mick Ronson. And on two of the best versions, this one and the Lily version, he played on. And iconically as well, Nirvana did a cover of this, didn't they, on their Unplugged album?
They did. Which, I was going to say, it's so familiar, so I know the Nirvana version a lot better than this one, actually.
Yeah, and Kurt Cobain actually plays a bum note on it, where it's really, he goes, anyway, that's another thing. But let's not worry about it. That's a great version as well, but it's a great song. But let's talk about Mick Ronson.
You talk about it. You love Mick Ronson.
Well, he's, again, one of my... he's an unsung hero of rock and roll, as far as... And from all the documentaries you see and the books that you read, Rono was really screwed over financially by Bowie, which is not very good. And it went down a lot in my estimation of that, David Bowie. But because he created such a great sound for him, you know, because he wasn't, and we're going to feature him quite heavily in these next two shows, because he wasn't just a guitar player, he was an arranger as well. He played piano, he arranged orchestral pieces, you know. And, you know, his late 60s Les Paul became a classic icon of him and David Bowie, you know, with the glam rock stuff on, you know, that fuzz. And later on we're going to talk about a little bit of wah-wah pedal as well through Marshall, you know, pretty basic, but it was the way he played and also the lines, because, you know, these lines, that, you know, that riff there is one of the, you know exactly what song it is.
Yeah,
and you know
do.
Exactly who's played it.
It's weird, isn't it?
And it's like Frippo saying before, you know exactly who's playing on that. And because it's, you know, it, there's something about the lines that they do and that actually add to the song in such a way, it actually becomes part of the song and really should get a songwriting credit, if you know what I mean. Because it you know, there's lyrics and the music, you know, or the melody, but the actual backing and the whole thing. And, of course, Visconti was always very smart, being American. He got points on virtually everything in the early album, so he was rolling in it and still is rolling in it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's Mick Ronson, you know. We just love him.
What I'm learning about as well is that it's one thing to master an instrument in terms of technical prowess and just being able to play, but to actually to create a part with the song in the studio, or even just to write a song or write a part, that's like a whole new dimension to being a musician.
That's right.
And I don't think I'd appreciated that enough, really, especially when I started to write the bass parts. For Blueberry Pie, I'd written songs, but, you know, when it comes to thinking about the song and the layers of the cake or the sandwich, as it were.
Yeah.
It's quite... I've just knocked the mic.
Yeah,
I get excited.
You're waving your arms.
I am.
Gesticulating furiously.
Well, what was... I love these stories. And for me, Mick Ronson was a quiet-spoken chap who was a municipal gardener from Hull, which is in the north of England, and they speak from Hull, like that. They're very flat vowels. A lovely, lovely guy. And what happened was that there was a guy called John Cambridge who'd played drums in Space Oddity, and he was asked to get a guitarist to play on Bowie's next album. And they didn't want... So he said, how about my mate Rono? So he drove back up in his Morris Minor, apparently, and he said to him, come on down to London, and they met. And he went, really? What, you'll get paid? You know, because, I mean, this is an amazing thing to go, actually, you know, yeah, if it all works out, you're going in the studio, mate, and you're going to get paid, and you're going to record on a real album, you know, the album that you can buy in a shop.
Wow.
So, and it was really like, because that never happened to anybody, or very few people. So he went down and he met Bowie and at the Marquee Club, and they got on. And in 2 days, he'd learned 15 songs, and he was playing live at a John Peel concert at a theatre in London.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting? So that's just amazing how quick your life can change just like that. But what I was quite intrigued by is it was quite a deliberate move. What Tony Visconti and Bowie wanted to do was write a rock album, and they realised that Space Oddity was not the album that they wanted to write. And they loved Cream, but they knew they didn't have that kind of edge in themselves as musicians. So they needed to bring in that extra a perspective that would give them the rock edge, and of course ended up being perfect foil for Bowie, really, because
because of the look as well,
kick ass, you
know? And Woody Woodman's was playing drums on this, so this is like a proto Spiders from Mars sort of
exactly
thing. And but you know, the main thing about that track, you listen to it again, it's all about the guiro.
I was gonna say the guiro, right? That it sounds like the frogs
it
in
sounds
the
like a frogs in a pond.
I know, I'm thinking, here we are again. The percussion's quite noticeable on that track. When you listen to it, the headphones on, you hear that and the egg, whatever it is using. But I mean, I love, I was just reading as well that Dana Gillespie, because we Phil Brown's really good mates with her, and she used to date David,
like,
didn't
she? Next month,
well, hopefully that would be really great. But she was talking about that, saying in the early days, you know, David did rely heavily on Mick, you know. But I think you go through phases where you do, and you grow, and you're sort of musicians. But we just love Mick Ronson.
We'll be right back.
David Bowie, Rebel Rebel, released as a single on the 15th of February 1974 on the RCA Victor record label, and also 2 months later on his eighth studio album, Diamond Dogs, one of my particular favourites, recorded at Olympic and Ireland Studios and at Lundolf Studios in the Netherlands. The first Bowie album since 1969 not to feature the Spiders from Mars, but a couple of the tracks did have Visconti on them. I did Ronno and Woody Woodman's on them. But the reason why we wanted to choose this is that this is David Bowie playing guitar.
Exactly. Now, how do you come across David Bowie on guitar with that riff?
Well, it's a great riff. And if you've ever tried to play it, it is really tricky because it's almost been written by somebody who's never played the blues before. It's like really awkward,
yeah,
you know, because of the back, you know, there's a lot of back on the pick, and it's a odd riff, and he's got a great sound, but you know, it's like he's taken Mick Ronson and done, I think he's done this as a Strat, and it's quite it's a great sound. Of course, the track's fantastic. The album's sensational. And Herbie Flowers on this, on bass, and what a great, some great bass line on that.
I know that bass line. I play that song. It's just, it's phenomenal. It
now
really
that's
is.
What a precision bass sounds like, isn't it? That's a P bass.
Ah,
there.
See, because there you go. There's all these different guitars that have a different sound to them. And as I get more experience and get more guitars in my stable of
armory, darling.
Yeah, exactly. You really learn to appreciate it, and it's all about emotion for me. It's like, how does that feel? How do I want it to feel? And it's like, oh, I need something short and punchy. I'll get my short scale, or I want something a bit more smooth. You know, so if I'm I'll have my Mike Lowell. Just because it's smooth and it's just lovely. It's got a bit of a punch to it, and then you know. So anyway, it's really exciting. And it is good though, because Bowie isn't, you know, it's a clunky riff, but it's one of those riffs that goes on longer than even probably Keith Richards would dare to do with the Rolling Stones.
It just keeps going and going and going, doesn't it?
And it's really, they say as well that Bowie had unleashed a monster, an undying, dangerously addictive riff that would terrorise nightclub stages and guitar centres for years to come. Well, there's a story as well. Apparently Bowie was in a hotel room one night and he heard Rebel Rebel. And it went on and on and on, and he got so annoyed because this riff was dee-dee-dee-dee. He went down from his room to have a go at the guy who was playing, just like, shut up. And it was John McEnroe. You cannot be serious. So David Bowie and Queen Bitch. What a great title. And that was from his fourth studio album, Hunky Dory, released on the 17th of December in 1971, and his first release on the RCA record label. It was also the B-side to the single release of Rebel Rebel.
Yeah.
Whoa, so you get two top songs.
Yeah. And that's all about Ronno and his backed off wah-wah pedal, because most of Ronno's sound came from the fact, I think that's a Telecaster he's playing on that, I might be wrong, but it doesn't sound like his Les Paul. It's a fuzz,
yeah,
and then into a well, crybaby or something, wah-wah. Rather than having it fully, if you know what a wah-wah pedal is, it's basically a pedal that you, if you push it right forward and push it down, it'll make it very trebly, and as you pull it back, it'll be...
Right.
So, and you'll listen to it. Really, one of the main things is Shaft. You hear Shaft. You know, remember Shaft? And that is it. But what he did, he backed it off a little bit. And you've heard me do this, you know, and you back that wah-wah pedal off a little bit. What's happening here? The hummock's digging in the background.
Is
over
that hummock or Bob?
I don't know. It's Bob. Somebody's
well, they're scratching.
Digging. Yeah, they're scratching.
Yeah, so carry on about the wah-wah pedal.
Yeah, right. So, and that's what gave him his distinct sound. A lot of the tracks in the early 70s he did with this, with Bowie. And it's absolutely a classic, you know. And this has got the classic Spiders from Mars lineup on it, with Trevor Bolden now replacing Visconti on bass, Woody Woodsman's Ian drums, and also this was produced and engineered by the lovely Ken Scott of the Beatles fame, and many other people.
Wow.
I think it tried the studio. So, yeah, but this is like proto-glam, you know. And we love that he's using that word proto now, but it's isn't it? It's proto-glam, it's proto-punk, it's all that sort of stuff. So talk to me about Hunky Dory.
Well, I didn't realise that Rick Wakeman was playing keyboards on that.
Indeed.
He was in the Strawbs at that time.
He was.
I really love Rick Wakeman. He's a real character.
One of our big mates is in the Strawbs now, isn't he?
Of course, Dave Bainbridge.
Yeah. And one of our biggest supporters in the whole world, Craig and Hilary Larson in America. They saw him recently, did they not?
They did at their 50th anniversary.
Anyway, we'll talk about the story.
When you start to read about sort of what's going on in terms of Bowie's sort of songwriting, he was saying there was like a collision of musical styles, and he found that he couldn't, when he was exploring this, and especially, you know, when he was trying to get a foothold and he was friends with Elton John and Mark Bolan and T-Rex, and their careers were taking off, and he was going, you know, and he was, after Space Oddity, he didn't quite get that traction that he needed. So he was trying to work out where he was, and he's saying that he couldn't really adopt sort of like a brand loyalty or a genre loyalty. He wasn't R&B, he wasn't folk, just pure folk, and he didn't see the point in trying to be puristic. So he loved the idea of putting different genres together, like Little Richard with Jacques Brel and the Velvet Underground backing them, you know. So he was thinking about those kind of sounds and what that would mean musically. So that's kind of partly his approach. And he was saying as well, which is so beautiful, and you forget that Bowie struggled a lot in his life, and he was actually skinned in his early years, especially when he was just about to have a baby with Angie, and they used to live in this ground floor flat. It had an hall. And apparently Mick had gone back up north to carry on gardening because nothing was happening. And he just said, look, there's nothing going on in Hull. Come back down. And they all moved in together.
That's what Haddon Hall's, right?
Yeah, so all the band moved in. So what David Bowie was saying about Hunky Dory, he said it gave him a fabulous groundswell. He said it provided, for the first time in his life, with him with an actual audience. I mean, people were actually coming up to him and saying, good album, good songs. And that hadn't happened to him before. It was like, I'm getting it. I'm finding my feet. I'm starting to communicate what I want to do. Now, what is it I want to do? There's always that double whammy thing.
We'll be right back. right down.
Waiting for the gift of sound and vision.
And I will say,
waiting for the gift of sound and vision.
Drifting into my solitude.
About sound and vision.
David Bowie, Sound and Vision, from his 11th studio album, Low, released on the 14th of January, 1977 on the RCA Records, produced by Bowie and Tony Visconti and recorded at Studio Chateau de Urville in France. And the rest of the album, some of it was recorded at Hansa, the very famous Hansa Studios by the Wall in Berlin, which we watched a documentary very recently about. But again, Carlos Alomar on guitar.
Indeed. He's back again.
He is.
Well, the thing is that, of course, Carlos was kept in the band because of course, his jazz knowledge as well and his chord knowledge. So he says things like Bowie used to come to him with a song that sounded a bit like Chopsticks, very simple at the beginning. And he would show him like 15 chord substitutes for a song and he'd go, oh, well, that's interesting. Let's do that. And we know that from when we start doing inversions and different chord substitutes.
That's right,
it opens up a whole new world.
You can sing the same melody over the same
It's like
a
psychedelic trip in chord language, isn't it, when you go,
Well, the lead guitarist was Ricky Gardner, who actually played on Iggy Pop's album and actually did The Passenger, you know?
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, and that whole thing, which was recorded at Hansa Studios and stuff. And again, it's Dennis Davis and George Murray on the rhythm section there. Brian Eno on synth. Mary Visconti on backing vocals. But Chateau de Urville, or whatever it is, I don't know how you pronounce it. But very famous, because Elton John recorded there.
He did.
And
Jerry Garcia.
Yeah.
Apparently the Grateful Dead went to do a festival there and it got rained off, so they just did a gig in the gardens of the chateau.
Is that right?
Yeah, and just like the local fire brigade came down, it was just like for local people, and just kind of took off. It was one of these places, but apparently there was a bedroom where the master bedroom Bowie wouldn't sleep in because he said it was spooky.
Yeah, that's right. And Ken Scott worked there. I mean, the books that we've read recently, you know, it's all this in there. But it's a fascinating, the whole Berlin trilogy, you know, with Low, Heroes, and you know, I mean, just a great set of records, but very, very unusual.
And what Bo used to do was turn the lights off and get him to listen to the songs in the dark, because he was led by his emotions.
Wow.
So that was part of the whole of this creative process for these particular albums.
Back in Atlantic City.
David Bowie and Dead Man Walking. And that was written by David Bowie and Reeves Gabrels and released as a single from his 20th studio album, Earthling, originally released in February 97 on the Arista record label, and went to number 32 in the UK. And it was the first album he recorded digitally.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and they got a Grammy for that, I think, or nominated for a Grammy. Yeah. So Reeves Gabrels on guitar there, very crazy American guy.
Yeah.
Not hugely fan, but he added the sound and he brought something new to that whole thing. And Gaylan Dorsey on bass on this one as well.
Well, yeah, I love her. It's great.
Great.
But what I didn't know anything about Reeves, and he was born in Staten Island, New York, and went to Berklee School of Music in Boston, you know.
No.
Yeah, he did.
Ah.
So it's kind of interesting. And he met Bowie in 1987. His wife was a publicist on the tour, and he ended up joining Tin Machine. So
that's
he
right,
was with
yeah.
Tin Machine for a while. And
not
then
a bit
he,
of fun, but...
he went on, no, and then he went on and he worked with him on Outside and in 1999's Hours. So, I mean, this guy, though, he's like, he's renowned for being as inventive as Hendrix, they say, with this
well,
guy.
Yeah.
Well, that's
I'm
what
not
I've read.
A huge, I'm not a monster fan, but I think he's suitably.
Suited the time.
Yeah, yeah. And, it, you know, and it's a very industrial sound, this sort of jungle and a lot of programming and stuff, you know. But, you know, it's an interesting album. Not one of my favourites, though.
No, that's cool, though. But at least, well, I hope you've enjoyed this week's show. And anyway, next week we're having part two of Guitar Players with David Bowie.
Yeah, and it's been great. You're going to really like this next one because I'm loving it. Loving it. Loving it. See you next week.